International, Inc. versus International Longshoremen's Association et al. 15 minutes for plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by defendants. Ms. Cooley, you may proceed for the appellant.
Looks like we need appellee counsel at the table here first, right? Before we get going. Whenever it's good for you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lauren Cooley, and I represent Midwest, the appellant, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
No one disputes that in the statute before the court, Congress prohibited unions from deliberately restraining a neutral in order to put pressure on the primary. No one also disputes that the neutral international ships have been alleged to have been restrained when they were prevented from entering and leaving the port. The issue that's left before this court is whether the unions can nonetheless escape liability on a motion to dismiss by using an intermediary to restrain the ships. And the answer is no.
Okay. Wait, I'm sorry, you finish up your opening.
Sure, I wanna get right to your questions, Your Honor. Okay. And what I was gonna start with is that there's no limit in the text of the statute on the manner or mechanism that the unions use to achieve the restraint. There's
well,
no exception.
I mean, let's say, just hypothetically, so the ships are coming into the port. They're coming from Lake Erie, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say hypothetically that they have to make a fuel stop for some reason to be able to get all the way into the port. And the union here, instead of enlisting the support of the pilots, They talk to the fuel vendors and say, hey, we're just really unhappy with the way we're being treated, and we'd ask for your support. Don't sell fuel to these ships that come in. Is that a violation of this act here? And so the vendors say, you know what? We stand with you on, you know, some sort of like highly principled basis. We think it's almost a human rights issue or whatever, and we're not going to sell fuel to these people. We're just not going to do it. And thanks for letting us know about the situation. Is that the union restraining ships from coming in, or is that just some independent actor making a decision that has the effect of the ships don't come in?
Yes, Your Honor. And there are two components to your question, as I understand it. One is, what's the conduct? What's the union doing that restrains? And then also, to what extent does that implicate speech or expression or communication?
No, I'm not really at all talking about speech.
Okay.
But so, what I'm talking about is a third party makes a voluntary decision not to provide a service, which has the effect that the ships don't show up. Mm-hmm. Is that the union forcing the ships not to show up?
Yes, Your Honor. And
my hypo?
Yes, Your Honor. There may be a causation question in there where there are multiple causes, but the union's conduct only has to be a substantial factor, and it is in that case. It's like if I went out and put landmines in the port, and then I walked away. It is not my presence there or me physically restraining the ships. It's the landmines, arguably, but we would still say that I acted to restrain the ships. I restrained the ships. And that is for a good reason under the statute. The statute prohibits the unions from intentionally targeting third parties, the neutral ships.
You're kind of bringing in the foreseeable consequences of one's actions, right? But I think it's got to be a coercive action by the union before we start saying, okay, what are all the consequences of that?
But what we would say, though, is that the union is perhaps using the fact that the ships are dependent upon fuel. The statute doesn't require the unions to go out and physically grab the ships and restrain them. So the question is, how are they accomplishing that restraint? And what this court's case law has said is that unions must focus their activities on the primary, What they cannot do is
exert. The primary here?
The primary here is Midwest. There was a labor dispute between the unions and Midwest. There was no dispute with the neutral ships. That's undisputed.
It seems to me your argument turns on or requires that there be an agreement between the union and the pilots to distinguish this hypo. Because normally when, as I understand it, when unions picket, I mean, they're trying to persuade people that they're right and that other people, you know, should look disfavorably and perhaps not buy something from the employer, but they're not actually agreeing with the neutral intermediary, so to speak, to deny business to the employer. But here you're alleging that, aren't you?
We are, Your Honor.
So isn't that the kind of the key to the case, that there's an agreement?
That is absolutely a significant distinction that would take this outside of Judge Kethledge's hypothetical. What we have here is an agreement to do what the statute says the unions cannot do, an attempt for the unions to use an intermediary to achieve what Congress has said they are not allowed to do. And so to ratify the union's theory would be to permit them to evade the statute in that fashion. The agreement itself is conduct. There's speech that is uttered, words are uttered, but it is in fact the act of enlisting the advance help of the pilots that is conduct and doesn't depend on the force of an idea. In Wilhelm, this court's decision, the court was interpreting the same statute at issue, that's in footnote 1, it's section 2B of this statute, and the court held that soliciting advanced help from the secondary, the neutral employer's workers to staff a picket line, there was enough evidence that was done to deprive that neutral of its workers and to shut the neutral down, and that was done in order for the neutral to pressure another party with whom the union had a dispute. And the court concluded and had that language in that decision about what the union may do and what the union may not do.
Was that under the same subsection?
Yes, Your Honor. The my friend on the other side says it's a different subsection, but if you look at footnote 1, the provision being interpreted is the prohibition against coercing, threatening, or restraining a neutral in order to put pressure on the primary. So that case is on all fours in the sense that the unions have reached an agreement in advance with someone else to restrain, to do what they cannot do.
I'm not looking at your complaint at the moment, but I mean, the union folks are basically picketing, kind of, they're out in the water and whatever. They're signaling their unhappiness with Midwest, I guess. And I mean, was there really something we would call like a meeting in the mind? I mean, like a legal agreement with, did you allege a legal agreement?
We did, Your Honor. We agreed an express or implied agreement that was obtained in advance, and that this explains why this coordinated activity was so effective. The unions coordinated their water pickets, which generally involved going out on a pontoon boat when particular ships were coming and going that they wanted to trap at sea or trap at the dock, and identifying those ships, getting on the radio, even talking to the pilot directly, and targeting, undertaking a coordinated campaign to ensure that these ships did not have a choice in the matter. These ships were at sea, trapped with their cargo and crew. There's no indication or suggestion here that
the ships didn't have a choice in the matter. Are you saying the pilots, the owner of the ship? What are you saying?
So the neutral here are the international shipping companies that have and the pilots are a separate entity.
Okay, so you mean the owners of the ships?
That's correct. So their boats with their cargo and their crew are stuck out in the lake or stuck at the port for weeks at a time. There's no suggestion the unions ask the ships, ask their management to voluntarily support this effort. What is alleged here is that the unions went out and did exactly what Congress says you can't do. And how were they going to accomplish that? I mean, how else would you do that but, you know, have to go through the, you know, the, an advance agreement with some other intermediary? And so the statute doesn't permit the unions to go hire an independent contractor to do what they're
not allowed. You don't allege in the complaint anywhere as to why the pilots agreed to this, do you?
No, Your Honor. And
do we not have, isn't that part of the plausibility analysis of whether or not there actually is an agreement? Don't you have to allege some consideration or some reason why they would have entered into an agreement?
Your Honor, I think it's plausible from the allegations in the complaint that it could have been a quid pro quo, it could have been for all we know, there was a financial component. This case is at a motion to dismiss. There's been, you know, some written discovery exchange, but no deposition, no discovery schedule was even in place. So to, at the outset, conclude that Midwest can't attempt to prove its case or get that discovery would be to, you know, give a workaround, essentially, to the statute any time the unions choose to outsource unlawful conduct.
But if, I mean, if you just say they had an agreement, I mean, that's just a legal conclusion, really.
Your Honor,
to sort of
correct.
Give us some facts that plausibly allow one to infer that there was such an agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. And the facts that I would point to are the fact that the unions, every time the unions undertook this activity, the pilots did what was requested, and that it was essentially like clockwork. That the unions took credit as well in their press release and in their communications with the Port Authority that they had that there was them that had blocked and had trapped the ships.
Now, the complaint doesn't allege that every ship was blocked. Right. I mean, there are some ships that got through. We're allowed to.
I believe it alleges, or at least can be inferred, that every time the unions chose to target a specific international ship, that the pilots complied and this blockade was in effect.
But you're not alleging that Midwest was denied all ships.
So Midwest was at that time the only terminal for international ships.
Right, but there were some ships.
There may have been, but it is the case that this activity made Midwest radioactive. The international ships did not want to come and dock at Midwest when this was happening. Ships went to New Orleans, they went to Cleveland, they went to Detroit. They avoided Midwest. The blockade accomplished what it was intended to accomplish.
This was intermittent, right?
There were, in the complaint, there are allegations of, I think, 7 or 8 throughout a year and a half period.
Well, how do you deal with these cases where, you know, you have like the shopping center where you're telling people not to buy things at the stores?
Sure, Your Honor. DeBartolo is a First Amendment case involving core, protected, classic First Amendment speech, leafletting. To a general audience, the consumer, the public, advertising or promoting...
Is picketing a First Amendment activity also?
Your Honor, the picketing is construed as having a conduct component that is not protected necessarily by the First Amendment. DeBartolo and Safeco, the decisions we've cited, recognize that there is that picketing is different from speech. DeBartolo, the First Amendment case law, involves pure speech, the about as traditional of protected speech as you can have, and expressly distinguished the conduct scenario, picketing in that example. What we have here is even more than picketing. We have a concerted agreement, a coordinated plan to coerce the neutral. And that takes us back to the Safeco line of cases that we cite in our brief, where when a union appeals to a third party in order to coerce the neutral, and that's reasonably likely to be successful, and they're doing something that will effectively shut down the neutral, that is coercion within the letter and purpose of the statute. I see that my time has expired.
So I just, okay, I want to make sure that I understand your argument. If it were the case where the union was picketing, which is their right, and there were certain pilots that said, I don't cross a picket line, and, you know, went back, their own decision, would that be a violation?
Your Honor, if what you said, it sounds like what you're describing is a traditional primary picket, a picket that is aimed at Midwest, in fact, and that is also directed to the general public. The pilots are receive that message in the course of that picket. That would be protected activity.
Okay.
What we have here is different.
Let me finish.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry.
The problem here is the allegation that there was an agreement that with the pilots that when they saw the pickets, they would freeze the ships. And that's the core of your case.
Absolutely.
And you're saying that you pled enough that the case should not have been dismissed.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I would point the court to Justice Stevens' concurrence in the Safeco decision, which distinguishes between conduct that elicits automatic response to a signal and communication that elicits a reasoned response to an idea. And the statute is designed to prohibit the former, the conduct as you described, which in this case was an agreement that was effectuated prior to the picket and then also reinforced through the union's conduct during the picket, you know, getting out on the pontoon boat, getting on the radio, and so on. Thank you.
All right, you'll have your rebuttal. We'll hear from the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Sheridan, for the defendant appellee, International Longshoremen's Association. The issue in this case is that unions are entitled to appeal to and persuade basically any entity or any person to boycott an employer. And when that union, the only exception to that under the statute, and it's a narrow exception, is they're not entitled to appeal and persuade an employee of the employer. So there's no dispute that the pilots here are not employees. It's very clear in the complaint that they are employers or self-employed individuals, independent contractors. So when the union approached the pilots and persuaded them that a boycott was something that they wanted to engage in, that is completely legal, completely lawful. And
who makes the decision where the boats will go into port?
Where the boats will go into port?
It's the ship owners, right?
The ship owners are told by their shippers, I want to ship it on this vessel that's going to Toledo. So, yes, the ship owners make a decision to approach the, probably coordinating with Midwest, we're going to come tomorrow.
If I understand correctly, it wasn't simply the individual pilots who decided that they're going to join the boycott. They coerced the ship owners and shippers to boycott Midwest because it was the only way they were going to get their goods to shore. I mean, you're not contending that all of these shippers voluntarily agreed to boycott Midwest.
Well, Your Honor, one of the primary tools that labor organizations have is boycotts, whether it be asking employer to boycott, asking consumer to boycott. And often when the consumer or the employer makes the decision to boycott, that hurts intermediary employers. That affects even intermediary employers.
But the key here, there in your high, and what you're saying is that it's a voluntary boycott. What they're alleging is that they were coerced to boycott.
Yes, Your Honor. But the
restrained,
the,
you know,
or restrained.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand what they're
restrained
alleging
from doing business.
But for example, in this case, this court in the Storer case, for example, there was a primary dispute with a television channel. The unions represented the employees of the television channel went out to different businesses and said, "We're going to ask for a consumer boycott of your business if you don't stop advertising on this television channel." So obviously, the individual businesses that advertise on the television channel are affected and negatively affected by that consumer boycott. But this court held that that appeal to non-employees and persuading non-employees to engage in a boycott was a lawful. Again, my colleague has suggested that there's no First Amendment implications in this case, but there always are with the 8B4 statute.
Well, I mean, but what they're suing you guys for is the conduct. And I mean, here you have ships that want to do business with Midwest,
sure,
right? That's common ground here,
sure,
right? And so the union allegedly enters into some, they say, express or implied agreement with the pilots, who, it turns out, under a statute, have the power to prevent the ships from doing business as they want to. And so they're asking us to treat, by reason of the agreement, they're asking us to treat the union and the pilots as one for purposes of this statutory provision, because they're acting in concert, allegedly. And it's the union's specific intention that these ships be prevented from doing business in the manner they want to do business. And so why, I guess, you know, why is it so unreasonable to say, okay, in this instance, we're going to say that the union did, the union restrained somebody from engaging in commerce? Is there a case that forecloses that? You answer how you wish.
Well, Your Honor, I just wanted to say that, you know, my colleague was expressing that there was an express or implied agreement, and I believe you asked, you know, that was right. Sort of a conclusory. There's no facts to allege an actual legal contract here. There's been a lot of development of this record prior to this complaint. They were up before the National Labor Relations Board. One would assume that they would have put the detailed allegations of a contract in the allegations of the complaint, but it's not there.
I'm saying there has to be a written contract.
But any sort of legal contract is what Judge Kethledge was asking, and I don't think it's an agreement in the most colloquial term. It's just simply an acquiescence or they've been persuaded to go with their usual thought that they don't want to engage in a labor dispute and they don't want to support the management of the labor dispute. I mean, the Coast Guard regulations require pilots to pilot ships in and out of terminals in Lake Erie and the surrounding rivers. The Coast Guard regulations also recognize that they don't have to pilot as independent contractors, as free actors in the economy. They don't have to pilot if there's a labor dispute.
When do the pilots get their contract to pilot the ship?
When I did, you know, that I don't know. I mean, I know the Coast Guard regulation says that they may, and it's in our brief as a footnote, says that they may agree to or elect not to pilot the ship at any point in time that they become aware of the labor dispute. So I don't know how they get their contract.
I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I
totally get your point about the union is entitled to persuade people not to do business with an employer whom the union thinks is acting inappropriately in some way. But I mean, here the party persuaded, I mean, this is what I guess makes this maybe a challenging case, is that the party that the union persuaded is preventing someone else from doing business with, I guess, what you all call the primary Midwest. And so that's a different circumstance, a materially different circumstance from the union just persuading someone themselves not to do business. They're persuading someone who's now restraining or interfering with someone else who wants to do business.
Yeah, but that's often the case. It's certainly almost always the case with consumer boycotts. The consumer boycotts the secondary, and the secondary is harmed not because of anything they specifically they did, but because of their relationship.
Secondary, help me. I'm
DiBartolo or a store, for example, mm-hmm. going to the mall and saying we don't like the construction companies doing work in this mall. We ask the consumer not to patronize any of the stores in this mall.
But the consumer, I mean, the party that ultimately would do business. So you have the primary, the employer of the union. members.
Yep.
And then you have someone who's going to decide whether to do business with the primary. In the mall example, the customer is deciding not to do business.
Exactly.
There's no one who wants to do business with the primary who's being blocked from doing so as a result of the union's activities. Here there is. The ships want to do business with Midwest. They're being blocked from doing so as a result, they allege, of an agreement between the union and the pilots.
Okay, I mean, the hypothetical, typically if somebody's picketing either primary or let's say a primary situation, mm-hmm. Suppliers, vendors, Teamsters with trucks will come and often will not cross the picket line, and that will prevent equipment, other items to be delivered to the primary. The person who is shipping those that equipment probably wants to get that equipment there or wants to get equipment out. This is a tool that labor has used for decades to interfere with the primary. And this, there's no allegations in this complaint that's alleged that it's secondary picketing. I mean, it's all about picketing around the primary situs. So these are typical things that happen with the primary. There's no allegations in the complaint that the secondary had any sort of specific damages. The allegations in the complaint are all about the primary's
damages.
Let's say
there's a mall, to build on Judge Bush's example, and the mall employs, I don't know, some, you know, they have some kind of union workforce. They're having a disagreement, and the workforce persuades a bunch of third parties, just, you know, other kind of Confederates who are not part of the union, they're just sympathetic, mm-hmm. to form a physical barrier or something close to it in front of the mall entrance. And they're sort of, you know, in a line, and they're making it very unpleasant, maybe not physically preventing, but making it kind of extremely unpleasant to enter the mall.
Okay.
And so people who just want to go in and buy a pair of jeans or something are showing up, and there's all this chanting and commotion, and people are de facto being turned away who want to do business. Is that a violation of the statute?
I mean,
the union restraining those people from entering in that instance?
Standard, that sounds like a pretty standard picket line, right? If
they're third parties that are out here doing this.
Okay, so but what they're, I mean, people can join, third parties.
They have an agreement. They're like, yeah, we'll help help us out next time.
The issue is who's the primary employer. If the primary employer is the mall ownership.
Right.
And then yes, the union employees can picket, and certainly anybody who wants to join a picket line can
picket. The union employees aren't picketing. They just get I don't want to belabor it, but they get, you know, some, let's say there's some other unions who provide other services and they have an agreement, hey, you know, you block the entrance for us and we'll do you a similar service down the road.
Well, I mean, the one specific thing that is prevented by this statute is persuading employees of an employer. So when you say other unions,
okay.
Makes
all right.
Think they're employees
that's
of
fair.
An
employer. All right.
No, that is the one that,
no,
and that,
no, that's
the
a
statute's
fair.
Limited, and that's what
the hypo breaks down.
Yes.
So.
Judge
White.
I see my time's up. Do you have a question?
I
you look poised. The question.
You're saying that the agreement, the alleged agreement, mm-hmm. is irrelevant. That
doesn't exist legally. It's not a legal joint venture. There's no allegation.
I'm asking a different question. This is judgment on the pleading. I mean, the case was dismissed on the pleading. So are you saying that it is hypothetically, if in fact the union had an agreement with the pilots that they would, whenever they saw the picketing, they would freeze the ships, that would in fact be legal?
That just a gratuitous agreement to, you persuaded us to boycott.
I don't know what you mean by a gratuitous agreement.
An agreement to boycott the ships. It's a boycott. Yes, boycotts are legal if you don't ask anybody who is not an employee of an employer. That's the statute. That's how it's been interpreted.
So you're saying that the agreement is irrelevant, that it's perfectly okay to go around asking third parties not to do business with the, I shouldn't say not to do business, because it's okay to ask third parties to, by their actions, cause other third parties not to do business with the employer.
Yes. It's okay to ask anybody other than an employee of an employer to boycott, meaning not to do business with any employer, even if that, you know, even if that delivery doesn't happen, even if the ship doesn't get piloted, even if the equipment is not sent out, yes, and even if that hurts the other neutral businesses, if that's how you persuade the non-employee to boycott. And that's how boycotts work.
Which are the cases that you say state that most clearly?
The persuasive consumer boycott cases, DiBartolo.
These aren't consumers. Consumers make independent decisions, I think.
I submit to you that there's nothing in the complaint that these individual independent contractors do not make their own independent decisions.
Well, but that's rejecting the allegations. I mean, I thought you were saying, wait a minute, I thought you were saying that the agreement is irrelevant. If there was an agreement, are you saying that it doesn't matter, that it's still perfectly okay to agree with another union or with whatever you want to call it of independent contractors not to do business with the primary, even if it has the effect of barring other people from giving business to the primary?
I'm saying yes, that
okay,
if I...
and then I said, what are the cases that say that? And you gave me consumer boycott cases, and I said, well, they're different because consumers make their own decisions. And then you went back to saying there was no agreement. So what are the cases that will clearly tell us that it's perfectly okay to have an agreement that you're, with independent contractors that they're going to boycott?
I mean, the steelworkers case that's cited in the district decision talks about how in a situation where you're at the primary situs and there's all sorts of independent entities approaching, whether it be vendors, whether it be suppliers, whether it be customers, whether it be other employees of other, even in that case where it's primary. And I submit there's nothing in the complaint that says this is not primary here. It's all around the primary situs. Anybody who approaches to do business is open for an appeal to boycott, appeal to stop doing business. You know, the purpose of a picket is to disrupt the business of the primary. And if that gets disrupted, the primary, if it's a legal primary picket, the primary cannot sue for damages. That's what a boycott is. That's what the leverage is. That's how the labor or movement has used as its leverage for decades. And when people agree to be persuaded to boycott any employer, then that agreement, freely, voluntarily entered into, is simply an independent entity acting within the flow of commerce. And the statute does not reach those independent decisions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate your argument. You okay?
Yeah.
We have more from the appellant side. I didn't cut you off, did I?
No.
ask a question.
Well, feel free to enlist, you know.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jonah Grabowski, on behalf of the International Longshoremen's Division, Great Lakes District Council, and Local 1982 of the International Longshoremen's
Division. How do you differ from, how does your client differ from Mr. Sheridan's client?
In terms of the legal entities, the local is a local entity. The Great Lakes District Council is the intermediate body, and then...
You're like the archdiocese here?
Yeah, something along those lines. All right, yeah, basically. And so,
how was your argument different than what you just argued?
Well, that's a fair point, Your Honor. There's not too much that's very different.
Okay, well then let me ask you a question I was thinking of to ask him, but I'll ask you. So it seems to me that that Midwest is relying upon 29 USC 158B4-2B. And according to their brief, they're saying it says it shall be an unfair labor practice for a labor organization or its agents to threaten, coerce, or restrain any person engaged in commerce or in an industry affecting commerce where an object thereof is forcing or requiring any person to cease doing business with any other person. So I think their argument is that the pilots are the agents of the labor organization. Therefore, under this statute, the pilots cannot threaten, coerce, or restrain any person engaged in commerce or an industry affecting commerce, which are the ships, where an object is forcing or requiring that person, the ships, to cease doing business with another person, which is Midwest. It seems like that's their case. So what am I missing?
It's our position, Your Honor, that there is no agency relationship between the pilots.
Okay, so what did they need to allege other than what they alleged? I think they alleged there's an agreement.
Yes, I think that the situation here is that in their briefs, they point to various portions of the Second Amended complaint suggesting that there was some instigation, ratification, or condoning of action. But what they were actually pointing to were allegations of that relationship between the actual individuals who were officials of the union, the district council, and Local 1982. And so there wasn't an elaborate allegation of an actual agency relationship. It was conclusory at best. And so,
do you have any cases talking about what needs to be pleaded under Twombly Iqbal for this kind of situation?
I think there are a couple of different cases. Basically, there needs to be ratification by conduct. There's an 11th Circuit case, Dowd versus ILA, basically suggesting that there needs to be some ratification by conduct and there needs to be some allegation of a joint venture relationship between the parties. And those allegations are simply not present.
What relationship between the parties did you just say?
Potentially a joint venture relationship. There are a number of other cases too that speak to that to that relationship. But I think the issue here is that there's just not enough in the complaint, the Second Amendment complaint, to actually explain the relationship between the pilots and the unions, other than the fact that there was a alleged agreement. There's just a paucity of allegations that there was any kind of relationship suggesting agency, and that the unions were the principal.
But other than agency, would you agree with me that that's the issue here? I mean, is there something else I'm missing?
I think another important issue, Your Honor, is to take a step back and think about this case where it originated. This is an 8B4B case, but that's the National Labor Relations Act. We're here in federal court under Section 303 of the Labor Management Relations Act because Midwest, as the primary employer, is alleging, and has alleged it suffered, quote-unquote, massive damages as a result of a unfair labor practice committed by the unions. But importantly, typically in the context of the National Labor Relations Board, there is a charge typically brought by a secondary employer. Usually it's the secondary employer who has suffered harm. They're saying that, you know, hey, we're not involved in this situation. The union has a dispute with the primary employer, and we're getting caught in the middle. So hypothetically, it'd be the shipping company, say, filing.
Yeah, but the Section 303 of the NLRA
authorizes private damages suits, according to their brief, for whoever is injured in his business or property. So that seems to be not just the secondary employers that could sue, could be the primary employer.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And the only reason I bring that point up is because in the retail clerk's case that that Midwest raises, it alleges that in order for there to be coercion by the union, even though it, you know, appeals to a third party, so in this case, the pilots, that what happened is that the secondary employer would face, you know, financial ruin or some sort of, you know, severe economic damages that would cause it, you know, to go under, in the, you know, something where the entire business would cease to exist because, you know, they're pushed in the corner. That's the coercion. Yes, they're alleging that the ships were not able to dock in their Second Amended complaint, but nowhere in the Second Amended complaint do they allege, and I mean this is important for purposes of a motion to dismiss, that the shipping companies suffered any specific damages. Now, I think maybe one can take it for granted, but it's important to allege that there were damages suffered by the secondary employer for purposes of being able to establish coercion.
Well, I mean, if we read the complaint in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, that would seem to be a fairly obvious inference that if the freighters are just, you know, sort of waiting in Lake Erie for any appreciable period of time, that there are going to be costs that result to the company that owns the ships and employs the folks on the freighter.
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor. I guess it just seems important that they rely so heavily on that case to say that there has to be damages by a secondary employer. They're saying that is the key of saying that the unions caused coercion because the secondary employer was suffering.
It's more than just coercion in the statute, though. It talks about threatening or restraining or coercion any person, and then with the object of forcing or requiring any person to cease doing business. You don't dispute that that the freighters ceased doing business under the that was alleged in the complaint with Midwest.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so really we're looking at, have they alleged enough to show either threatening, coercion, or restraint?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that they have not.
Okay.
Did the pilots restrain the shippers from using the port or coerce them not to?
Your Honor, it's my position that there was no restraint, coercion, or threats by any party, and if there was by the pilots, then that's not the union's problem. The union was not engaging in coercion, threats, or restraint. I think Midwest is arguing that if the pilots did, somehow that can be imputed to the unions, but our position is that under the variety of cases that we've cited in our briefs, you know, you can appeal to the public and say, you know, we're engaging in a boycott, you shouldn't do business, and essentially the pilots had you know, said, we agree with your position, we won't do business.
So, yeah, I mean, it seems like the dispute boils down here to, on the one side, you gentlemen are saying the union's appealing to the public here, and then the other side, they're saying that the pilots are an agent of the union.
Yeah,
and just because you agree with the union doesn't make you an agent, would be, I presume, what you're saying.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If the pilots were doing this based on an agreement with the union, just hypothetically, would that be a problem? Would that be a violation?
If there was an agreement, I think it depends on the nature of the agreement, Your Honor. I don't think it's a straight yes or no.
There were a quid pro quo. That might look a little different.
Yes.
Hey, you know, we're going to have our own dispute next year, and you guys, you know, help us out and impede this and that and help us now. I mean, that might look a little different. But
I think to that point, Your Honor, there's some discussion about signal picketing in Midwest briefs, and I think we address it as well in ours. But that would suggest that maybe there was a prearranged situation, but what we're arguing is that you can't have signal picketing when the recipient of the signal is not the employer of the secondary, and so the pilots were not employed by the shipping companies. They're independent.
That seems to be the key here, that you couldn't do this if they were employees. right?
If they were employees, that might be a different situation, Your Honor, but they're not, so, you know, we don't really get into that.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're way into the
Yeah, you know, this is not really part of the record. I probably shouldn't even ask this question, but I'm going to anyway. On the pilots, how do these pilots, and this is totally off the record, so maybe I shouldn't ask the question, but I will. Are pilots just assigned to ports? Is that or do you know anything about how the industry operates?
My unfortunately, I don't know quite as much to give you a satisfactory answer. I think that they do get assigned, and they're essentially independent contractors, but as co-counsel indicated, they're subject to various Coast Guard rules and regulations, and so that might impact where and when. I mean, I know that you have pilots who just work in Lake Erie, you have some pilots who work in Lake Superior, just all across the Great Lakes.
Yeah, I just wonder if they could bounce from Toledo to Cleveland. If they, you know, don't have enough business in Toledo, they can go up to Cleveland and do whatever.
That may very well be. Okay.
So they're not tugboats. They're just leading the freighter, kind of.
They're like airline pilots. They can,
yes,
they
exactly.
go to wherever the equipment is, and they drive it. They know how to drive it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. They're like.
Are they driving the freighter as they go in? Mm-hmm. Really, I didn't.
But they're hopping on the ship. Like
right. They're not there the
they
whole
didn't bring it the
they have
whole
a tugboat.
So they really
get
know.
A boat, the rowboat, I imagine, yeah, yeah. going out to the
They actually
ship.
Swim, Your Honor. No,
really? Are you serious?
They know, you know, where everything is in the harbor. And
that's right. Yeah, they have the know-how and the expertise to guide the ship into the
I didn't know that was going on. All right. Very good. Okay. We'll hear rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments.
Few points. First, our position is that the unions are both directly liable for their own conduct that accomplished this restraint and also vicariously liable under a theory that the pilots were the agents. But in either case, we don't necessarily need to prove an agency for the first case because if they're independent contractors, there may not be enough control, but that would still violate the statute because what you have here is an agreement to intentionally restrain a neutral third party
so you're
in violation
the
of the
agreement allows for direct liability.
That's correct.
Okay. And, so then, both, and then agency is only for vicarious. Huh.
That's correct. But and we argue both should be those theories should be viable for Midwest. Below a few responses to the case law.
How would the pilots become the agents of the union apart from an agreement? It would seem like the agreement is the agency is not a separate basis, separate from the agreement. You have to have, right?
Your Honor, you could have an agreement that doesn't have the level of control that you would see. You could have an independent contractor agreement.
Yeah, I mean,
a relationship.
The union doesn't control, right? The union does not control these pilots. You don't allege that they're under the control of the union, do you?
We do at page ID 486 and page ID 489, that they were acting under the control and direction.
What fact would support that? That seems highly counterintuitive.
The
union workers are controlling what these pilots are doing.
And Your Honor, and to be clear, we don't know what the evidence will show either way. And
is
so
there a fact that would allow me to infer that the union indeed had such control over pilots?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is that each of these pickets produced the response that the unions were seeking. That this coordinated campaign was so effective and so successful, it is reasonable to infer from that there had been a prior agreement and that there had been an agreement for the pilots.
Why isn't it just equally consistent with the union persuading someone and engendering sympathy from someone who then himself chooses to act in accordance with the union's interests?
Well, first, Your Honor, if both of those things are reasonable inferences, then we should still be able to move forward with our complaint at this stage. But second, the seeking the agreement to coerce the third party is prohibited. And I would point the court to the Kroger case from this court. And the Gottfried.
Sorry, which case?
The Kroger decision. And that it was actually short of an agreement, but it involved appealing to the public, in that case, actually consumers, to boycott a primary's good. In that case, it involved Kroger. And the unions had a dispute with the manufacturer of paper bags that were used at Kroger for bagging. This was before modern plastic and reusables. And the pickets were being held outside of Kroger. And the court held that that conduct was so targeted at, in fact, Kroger, and that by convincing consumers not to use Kroger's paper bags, they were effectively convincing consumers to completely boycott Kroger, that that was coercive conduct that violates Section 2B.
What case was that?
This is the Kroger decision. We cited it in our briefing. It's a Sixth Circuit decision that follows Safeco, the retail store line of cases. And it explains that when you're dealing with intentional targeted conduct aimed at the secondary that gets beyond incidental effects at the secondary, when we're not talking about an allegation of primary picketing, which one of my friends on the other side spoke about at length, when we're talking about an intent to coerce a secondary, and the reasonably likely effects of the conduct of the unions are such that they threaten substantial loss, that that is coercive conduct.
I don't see how you can look only at the, I think the effect is one of the prongs, but I don't see how you can look only at the effect if you're talking about primary picketing, because there are always going to be people who will not cross a picket line.
Your Honor, the statute does distinguish, of course, between primary and secondary. Our argument here is this is secondary, not primary. It's directed at the ships. The ILA concedes at page 18 in their brief that we've adequately alleged that intent.
I don't understand that, because it may have had that effect, but they're picketing at the site. They're picketing at the employer's site.
We allege that the pickets were actually in some cases a mile away from Midwest stock, and the ILA's brief acknowledges that. A lot of these hard cases involve a line between primary and secondary picketing, but that is a fact question that goes to the intent of the unions. And there are multi-factor.
They are way beyond sort of any property, so to speak, of Midwest when they're out in the ship, Yountzee or whatever is out there.
That's right, Your Honor. And if there was a question about whether there was primary versus secondary, first of all, the unions didn't argue that below. But in any event, that is, in fact, a fact question that would be developed on remand. There's multi-factor tests, one of which is the location of the picket. But there's no dispute here that we have adequately alleged the intent that would make it a secondary picket rather than a primary picket. And to Judge Catlett's point, the allegations are that this campaign included picketing out in open water. And so we're far beyond Midwest's dock at that point.
But I mean, they might just be trying to persuade people out there as well. A picket is sort of a physical barrier to going into a certain place of business. And that's not present here. Is that fair? There's no physical barrier. I mean, you need the pilot. I get that. But the union itself is not presenting any physical barrier. They're just, you know, getting that result with the pilots.
The picketing has coercive elements to it, and in this case there was picketing, but we're saying there's actually more than that and worse than that. There is an agreement, and there is a kind of coordinated, targeted attack on the neutral party that goes beyond even
being the ships.
Being the ships, correct.
Okay. All right. Well, we belabored this for some time. It's a fascinating case, and I see the freighters going by all the time in northern Michigan. So.
Well, we appreciate your questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both all for your arguments. Case will be submitted.